Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
All right, so after that short discussion, we're on episode 15 of the Chicago Gamepreneur Show. Look at that, twice in a row.
Okay. Yes. Okay. The pronunciation is tricky.
Gamepreneur.
Yes.
Gamepreneur.
So an entrepreneur that makes their...
I think I screwed up for the first dozen podcasts.
Gamatrepreneur?
I mean, it's a weird word to begin with, right?
It's very Googleable. That's the good thing.
That's true.
You're the only
that's what
we're going
for.
Yeah.
And our guest today is Craig Stern.
Hello.
Insert
applause noise.
I know, right? Insert popping champagne. And it is your second appearance.
It is.
Welcome back.
Year?
Like
a year ago.
Yeah, I think it's just about a straight year ago.
Nice.
So catch us up. We got your background last time, but since then...
Right. Let me just remind people where we left off.
That's your last time on the Craig Stern Chicago Gamepreneur Show.
Your Kickstarter had just succeeded. Your second Kickstarter had just succeeded for Telepath Tactics, Servants of God RPG. And, so we mostly talked about the Kickstarter itself. And it has since been released, the game.
Yeah.
It's out. You can buy it right now.
So the Kickstarter succeeded in 2013. Has it been that long?
Maybe. Damn.
It's 2016, so...
maybe not.
This is the part where we...
Well, I guess it was in development. It hadn't released yet. I know that for sure.
Yes.
I think we were hyping the release last time, so...
Yeah, so it released last April... 15th, I want to say, on Steam.
On tax day.
And
you get the refunds.
That's
and,
right. Exactly.
Wait, no, the refunds come much later. So they've just sent checks to Uncle Sam.
But
they realize they still have a little money in their bank account. Just enough for Telepath Tactics.
Maybe it wasn't the 15th. Maybe it was like the 23rd or something. I know I have like a little money. But anyway, yeah, so I released it, and, you know, it did well by some metrics and not so well by other metrics. It did well by, like, hobbyist indie metrics.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't do quit your day job well, which is what I was really aiming for.
We're all
in the same boat.
Yeah, we're all in that half day job, half night job, but...
Yeah,
but really good critical acclaim, right? Good article on Rock, Paper, Shotgun, and...
Yeah, the critical response to it was really nice. A lot of folks really appreciated the design. There were, like, multiple outlets that, you know, said it was, you know, like, super professional mission design. Like, yeah, no, it was really gratifying to see the critical response, even if I did not become the next John Blow out of it.
Well, you know what won the Oscar of the year Citizen Kane came out? Rebecca.
Friggin' Rebecca, man. She gets everything.
I'm just saying that it wasn't recognized as a great film until much later, so it could still happen.
That's true.
It's true. After I'm dead.
You could be Notch. You could be the dead Notch.
That's exciting.
So speaking of long tail, how is the long tail? Was it spike immediately and then immediately off, or is it kind of sustained itself over the time?
I mean, it still makes sales, but, you know, it is your typical, what would it be, hockey stick or inverted hockey stick? I forget which one is.
The inverted hockey stick is the one we show to investors.
It's a power law distribution.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
Yeah.
And then we show the other one when we actually show, like, real sales, right? So we just take a graph and we flip it, like, horizontally.
Yeah, so it's in the tail part of the distribution, right?
Oh, yeah. I feel it is one of those games, like, if I were, like, someone who was, like, new into Fire Emblem, and I played through it, and I was like, oh, I need more. Like, it'd be the perfect recommendation, right? Because it's right in that vein. So I feel it has like lasting power, and it might be one of those you keep.
It might be evergreen.
I think so.
I think it is for people who are familiar with the niche. I made an effort to make it accessible to people who are new to it, and I think sort of undermined that goal by making the missions really challenging. Like, I know that people who aren't familiar with Fire Emblem already, a lot of them sort of bounced off of it for that reason. So I have to make a mental note. Like, you know, I did really well within a certain niche of people who are super into those types of games. They play it and they're like, shit, this is really good. But, you know, for people who aren't already steeped in that background...
Me. Deterministic, turn-based.
Not even deterministic. Just you know, strategy RPGs. Hardcore strategy RPGs. You know, a lot of folks sort of bounced off because of the difficulty. And I'm going to make a much more concerted effort to have like an easy mode be the default in my next game, just so that people aren't bouncing off quite so hard.
Yeah, I remember the first time I was playing a Fire Emblem mission and one of my guys got critted, you know, like in the last battle before it, and it just wiped out like 2.5 hours of progress. And I just threw the game away for like two weeks. I was like, ah, this is ridiculous. And it is one of those things that you just have to understand is the nature of the gameplay. But the first time it is super frustrating.
Well, to be fair, getting critted is, in my opinion, total bullshit. And that's something that
it's
I
total
take
bullshit,
out.
Right?
Because, no, that's like the whole appeal of the determinism.
Mm-hmm.
Is you don't get stuff like that happening to you.
Yeah, and you built the game in a way to minimize that type of deterministic, or the random dice.
There is no randomness. It's chess.
There is like a very small amount of randomness that comes into play with status effect abilities. But status effect abilities deal deterministic damage, and the only thing that's randomized
so
is
it's
whether
just in the beginning when you like equip something, then there might be a small amount of randomness, but then you can tell what it's going to be from then on.
No, so like, let me give you an example, right? Okay. Like, so you know how like in a lot of RPGs you'll have like a sleep spell, and you cast it, and there's a percentage chance to put enemies to sleep, and either it works or it doesn't, and if it doesn't, you've wasted your turn.
Right.
I hate that. Yeah. I think that's terrible. So what I did in Telepath Tactics is you have, I guess what the closest equivalent to a sleep spell would be in that game is the freeze status effect, right? It causes enemies to become immobile and unable to act for a number of turns. So that's a really powerful ability. You can't have that be deterministic and always work, because then you would just spam it every turn and win every battle. Right, there would be almost no reason not to use that every turn.
Sure.
So what I did instead is I attached it to abilities like Cryoblast or Frost Breath, just straight up damage dealing abilities with the chance to freeze, so that you can use them, and even if you don't get the status effect, it's still not a complete waste of your turn.
Yeah, you're still dealing damage. Really,
so it's kind of smoothing the curve, if you will.
Yeah, very little in the way of randomness, and there are like ways to get around it.
It becomes icing, the randomness, instead of, you know, punishment.
Exactly. It's the special sauce. You don't like dump it on, you just put a little on enough to bring out the flavor.
Yeah, very good.
So maybe that's a good transition to what you're working on right now.
Sure, yeah. So after Telepath Tactics came out, I was like, well, that took 5 years. I don't want to spend 5 years on my next game. What's something I can do quickly?
Rock, paper, scissors.
I did. That took like 30 seconds, and I was like, well, okay, I guess I'm done with that now. What do I do next?
Something
I know.
In between 5 years and 30 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I looked over at my bookshelf one day, and I was like, hey, I have this prototype board game I designed back in college just sitting there a zillion years ago. Back in the day, I took this one game design class. This was before USC offered, like, a game design major, or, like, even a minor. They just had a class Mm-hmm. That was taught by, I think the name was Chris Swain and Tracy Fullerton, who you probably know.
Yeah, she's the head of the department now, and she just won the Ambassador Award at the IGF this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rob's going to just tip the mic over and walk out. You know? I know her.
So anyways, yeah. So
I don't know her.
You know of her.
I know of her, and we've met a couple of times at Games for Change and things like that.
Nice. Yeah, so anyway, so they taught this class, and it was, you know, I had been developing games here and there my entire life, pretty much, up to that point. But it was really cool taking the class because it sort of crystallized certain ways of analyzing game mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that particularly stuck with me from that class was sort of like the Kinsey scale, if you will, of luck versus determinism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I realized that I didn't really like luck-heavy games. Like, that's something I could have articulated before, but it gave me a good framework to think of various mechanics within.
Right. So this is, instead of saying Monopoly is bullshit, you say Monopoly is bullshit because of these particular mechanics.
Exactly. It's bullshit for more reasons than just the randomness, but
true.
That's a whole other discussion.
No one actually follows the real rules of Monopoly anyway.
Yeah, the rules that you create actually make Monopoly a better game because the original rule set is terrible.
Right.
So
The original rule set, I mean, it's like, it's, Monopoly is like a weirdly progressive game, like decades and decades ahead of its time, in that it's a game that's deliberately designed to not be fun, but instead to teach you about how shitty monopolies are.
That was the original intent. It was called, like, the Landlord's Game or something. This is before it was sort of cloned for the entertainment audience, but it was like a propaganda game originally.
Hmm. And then it was marketed as a game that's ostensibly fun, and I think that's the problem. It's not supposed to be fun.
Right. So really, when we get together on New Year's and people want to play Monopoly, we just say, well, this is actually a lesson in the downfall of capitalism, right?
Or
American
capitalism.
Right. When Donald Trump plays, he says, anyway.
Yeah.
So anyway, you had this prototype sitting around.
So I had this prototype sitting around, and I was like, hey, I made this. This was like my final project for that class that I made back in 2003, back, you know, in the Stone Age. And I was like, hey, I could just finish this up. I have, you know, all of this revenue from Telepath Tactics, not a lot, enough to let me quit my day job, but certainly enough to get art for this,
mm-hmm.
this board game that I'm sitting around. So that's what I did. I went back and I reworked some of the mechanics. I made it a lot more fun. And I improved the deck of cards that comes with it. And I went sort of searching around DeviantArt for artists with really cool, like, post-apocalyptic and surreal stuff in their portfolio, and I was like,
I've seen, your art is amazing, and it won't come across at all in the podcast format, but yeah, go,
we'll post it on Facebook.
Good.
If you go to the website truemessiahgame.com, Messiah is M-E-S-S-I-A-H, truemessiahgame.com,
mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of art posted there where you can just go look at it.
It's sick.
So how did the whole just picking artists off DeviantArt work for you? Because I've thought about doing it before, but I've never done it. Was it pretty successful?
It worked surprisingly well.
Okay.
Yeah, I found people whose work I liked. I created a list. Most of them either had their email in their profile description, or they had a link to a website where I could find their email there. A lot of them mentioned whether they were accepting commissions or not, so I was able to sort of like have like artist email accepting commissions. You know,
gotcha.
Sort of laid out like a spreadsheet, and then I just went down the list and contacted them and gradually winnowed it down to like five or so artists whose work I really liked and who were into it. Who were available. And yeah, so if you want to hear the names, I haven't released the names publicly before because I didn't want people stealing the artists out from under me. But now that the art's done, I have no problem saying. These guys have some pretty fantastic names. So I'll start with the most boring named artists.
Boring named. The art is not boring.
The art is excellent. David Hammond, who actually did art for me on Telepath Tactics. He did the art for the Extort card. Tim Barton, he did a few cards. The guy who did the bulk of the card art is named Rostislav Zagornov. I believe he's from Malta. He's really talented. Franklin Chan did a bunch of card art as well. He also did the box art, which is pretty sweet. You'll get to see that. I'll like show it to you.
Very nice.
And the guy that did the character designs for the actual messiahs, and he designed the backs and the fronts of the cards. His name is Chenthuran Nambiararan.
I feel like you just made that up.
No, didn't make it up. I hope I pronounced it correctly.
We'll post it on the link.
Yeah.
So how was it like?
What about the 3D models?
Oh, the 3D models. Of course, I have to mention that too. So David Mann. Who you may know as the guy that did the character models for Dad by the Sword.
He
I just like gave him the concept art. And he came up with these just uncannily accurate, detailed 3D model versions of them, which look fantastic. And, I've got them like 3D printed now, and I'm probably going to make the 3D prints available in one form or another. So that's a whole other thing, plastic injection molding. We can like get into that once we start talking about what it means to manufacture a board game.
Well, now's as good a time as any.
Well, I was actually going to ask, how was it like working with like such a big group of artists, right? Because I do commission work, but it's usually only with like one or two guys. What was it like for you kind of like pulling this like big group together to kind of... Was there issues with theme, or did they kind of know it? You picked the right guys and they just had good stuff.
So I guess I was kind of used to it already because that's what I did on Telepath Tactics. Like, I think I worked with 12, maybe, artists over the course of that game. Just there were so many assets that needed to be created.
Yeah.
You know, the game had like 23 character classes and just, you know, dozens of animations that needed to be done in four directions, and, you know, character portraits for an enormous cast of dozens of characters, and, you know, tile sets with, you know, numbers of tiles ranging up into the hundreds. So, I mean, there
were... So you had this flow that you could just kind of say, okay, this is how I manage my art, and it just kind of works like that.
I had to get very good at being very specific in terms of what I wanted, in what format, time frames, that sort of thing. So I'll be honest, like, creating the art for a board game is so much easier than creating the art for a video game that it really wasn't that difficult by comparison. Mm-hmm. Right, because all you're doing when you're making art for a board game, it's like the equivalent of the concept art phase for a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You're making 2D still images. The end. You're done. You did it. Good job.
That sounds great, because that's the most fun part for the video game part, where you're like, oh, this would look great. And you throw it in an engine, you're like, oh, no.
did they show you sketches first, and then you approved them, and then they painted them in, or...
Yeah, so some of them had, like, ways they liked to work, and I tried not to mess with that too much.
Mm-hmm.
A, because, you know, that's part of what makes them independent contractors. Mm-hmm. If you tell your artists...
If you take away their independence, then they're just contractors.
Well, if you take away their independence, you make yourself vulnerable to a claim that they're your employees.
Mm.
Which has legal ramifications you don't want happening.
don't get Ubered.
So yeah, I mean, I let them keep their processes, but usually I would insist on being able to, you know, give them feedback and get at least a good three drafts in before they were done with any given piece. I had a vision of the aesthetic going in that I tried to hew very closely to. based in large part on the works of, I'm going to butcher this guy's name, Vladislav Beksinski.
You nailed it.
Yeah. I'm sure I massacred his first name, but I'm pretty sure Beksinski is his last name. B-E-K-S-I-N-S-K-I. You should Google it. His stuff is crazy.
Those are the, like, really disturbing things with, like, stretchy people and, like, hellscape type things, right?
Those definitely sound like things he made, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was...
I think I've seen his stuff floating around on, like, image sharing.
Yeah, just websites. Absolutely hellish post-apocalypse with a lot of religious themes thrown in, which, you know, I was looking around for, like, a good source I could use to, like, provide my artist as a reference. And when I found his stuff, I was like, oh, yes, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, I found that it really helps when you have, like, a concept, if you can, like, provide some type of source material to the artist, then they have a much easier place to start from than just your wild, you know, ramblings on a page.
Did the artists communicate with one another, or was it just you to one to many?
I sort of handled that aspect of it. You know, I would provide them with each other's work as a reference. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if, like, you know, one person, like, for instance, right, Chen Thuram, he created the look of the Messiahs, right? He actually painted the sort of 2D painterly art you see of the Messiahs.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But there were, like, cards and other things where they needed to be represented. So I would send that to, I'm sure pretty much all of the artists at one point had that sent to them, so that they could match that style. Definitely. And get the details of the Messiahs right.
So how was the kind of the iteration of the play testing? As well, we already talked about, like, video games taking a long time to iterate because you're writing a lot of code, right? How was the play testing for you in the physical, like, the board format?
It was fine. Honestly, I did so much of it back in college when I first developed the thing, that there were only very specific things that needed to be playtested when I picked it back up again.
Okay.
I introduced a deck-building system to the game, and I rebalanced a bunch of the cards, so that needed playtesting.
Mm-hmm.
I expanded it from being a purely two-player game to supporting 2 to 4 players. So that required a lot of retooling and testing. But by and large, you know, a lot of the work was already done by the time I picked it back up again, so it wasn't too onerous.
Which is pretty nice to be able, like, since the medium hasn't changed that much, right, you can just kind of pick up from, you know, your college days and port it over, as opposed to, I imagine, that a lot of the video game concepts that I did 10 years ago are no longer relevant at all. Or, you know, just
the platform you were writing them for doesn't exist anymore. That was going to be brilliant for the Nokia 3800.
All my TI-85 games, guys. So you were talking about manufacturing. So we're through the art stage, we're through the playtest stage, and now we're actually building stuff.
Yeah, so...
So there's printing, there's the board itself.
Yeah, there's this weird catch-22... that I encountered in board games that I wasn't fully prepared for, because I entered it sort of fresh out of video games, where I had this very open style, I guess, of development, where I would, like, post on my forums all the time and upload screenshots and tweet screenshots and make short little videos and post those to my YouTube channel all the time, and, you know, I would, like, build an audience and keep people's interest, and it was great. And then I was like, wait a minute. All I have is this crappy museum board thing and some checkers pieces that are mismatched with some wooden discs and poker cards in plastic sleeves with just, like, printed out pieces of paper stuck in there. Like, I can't show this. People are going to look at this and be like, yeah, we're buying that. Good job. So it was pretty far into development before I even figured out how I could be, like, continually marketing it as I developed it.
So the hype train pulls out of the station much later.
Yeah, it has to, because otherwise it just
passengers
looks...
aren't aboard.
That's true.
Is the metaphor stretched out?
Yeah.
Yet?
Well, I imagine this very like crappy hype train with like, you know, it's like got the cars are falling apart. There's no
like those ones you see of like the Indian train with all the people on just like piled on top of it.
It's just a dude on a tricycle trying to go along the tracks, and it's really not working super well. Yeah, so I had to wait really until a lot of the art was finished.
Mm-hmm.
So that's.
I remember you teased it like a long time ago. I was like, "Oh, this looks really cool," and then there was this long time of just like media silence.
Yeah, so like the cards, right? Those were the things I think that were easiest.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of sell the game on, because each one has a unique, really cool looking piece mm-hmm. of art.
It's not the core of the game, though.
It's I don't know. It's like maybe 50% of the game.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Maybe 50%. But I don't know. I was really hesitant to actually post those images because the text is going to change as I continue refining it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you can just read the text on the cards.
Uh-huh.
What if I decide
to...
know
what the effects are.
Yeah, what if I decide to overhaul the design of the cards, right? Then I'm going to have all these images floating around that show the cards in a,
mm-hmm.
in a weird, unfinished state. Yeah, stuff like
There's
that.
There's people out there that don't trust in the heart of the cards. Right.
And, you know, like, the board itself, right? The board itself, the pieces, like,
that was
those
a Yu-Gi-Oh! Reference, by the way.
Just, I got it.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm a heathen. I don't know what Yu-Gi-Oh! I mean, I know what it is, but I don't know that much about it.
I never played it. I just watched
the show. Yeah.
Same with Pokemon. Never played it.
I mean, Heart of the Cards is basically that random draw bullshit they were talking about earlier.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Oh, please let me top deck what I need right now. And then they call it the Heart of the Cards. So,
yeah. It's basically, have you seen the movie Maverick? This is way
off
topic, but...
Yeah.
John Maverick?
Yeah, so at the very end, you know, how he just closes his eyes. He never looks at his cards. He's just like, I'm going to trust that I have two aces or whatever it is. And then it works. Well, that's what always happened for Yu-Gi-Oh.
Every episode.
Yeah.
Pocket aces.
I feel like he only had two cards, though. It was always like Blue Eyes, White Dragon, and I don't know. This is way off topic. I'm sorry. Go ahead. So the cards were compelling. People just posting those.
Yeah, but like, okay, so if you're gonna show like a shot of the game in action, or like do a promo video or
mm-hmm.
something of that nature, which is what I really wanted
life.
To do. Yep. Yeah, if you wanted to do that, first of all, if you have the even if the cards are completely done and you have them printed and you can show them, you still have this jank ass museum board that's your game board, and you still have like mismatched checkers and wooden discs.
Mm.
Like, your art has to be essentially complete before you have the vertical slice to mark it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the position I was in for much of the game's development. Like, it was only, you know, the past couple weeks, really, where I had everything in one place and I was able to actually shoot a video showing gameplay with,
yeah.
you know, finished art.
It's good stuff. Go watch this video.
So how long did the actual, like, figures take from, like, concept to getting it built to getting it like to a point where you could like show it?
When you say figures, you mean like the 3D models?
The 3D models, yeah.
It didn't take that long. I'm not sure if that's representative or if like David Mann is just magic, but
true.
Yeah, it was pretty fast.
He's a magic man.
He is. See what you did there.
If you will.
Okay, that's it. Neither here nor there. I was gonna say that my grandmother's maiden name was Man, and my dad always used to tell his school chums that his mother was a man before she was married.
I'm sure she really appreciated that.
We need to have like a running thread just for puns on the pod. We need
Craig
like a bell
is the
or
king
something.
Of puns. We yeah. If you could just, like, have a segment on our show where you just pop in and do a couple of puns.
A stern pun? A stern pun?
Hey, kids, want to hear some puns?
Get a Stern talking to from Craig Stern.
I like it.
I'm sorry. Please keep listening. So it was pretty fast then to get.
So doing the models in sort of digital space was fast. What was less fast was figuring out how to get the models big enough that we could print them with the necessary detail in 3D printing.
But not cost a million bajillion dollars because the
stuff so there's expensive cost considerations, but there's also just plain, like, the spaces have finite size.
Space is a thing. Right. We're not in the digital world anymore.
So, and, you know, in True Messiah specifically, like, you can have up to 5 units on a space. So there were some pretty, there were some significant constraints we were working within with that. But we managed to find something which works out perfectly, which I'm really pleased about. But that actually took a while. I had to order, like, 3 or so, like, prototype 3D prints before we, like, got it right.
So there's iteration that happens there, too.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, are you at the point where the game is pretty much in, I don't know, we call it release candidate form now?
I don't want to say that. So, we have finished art. And the rules are, like, there's, like, one more thing I really want to test. And it's purely, like, an optimization thing. I want to... I've been, over the past month or so, making tweaks to try to get the game to play as quickly as possible without sacrificing complexity. That was something that I didn't necessarily do super well in Telepath Tactics in, like, the local multiplayer mode. Like, there was a turn timer, but that was really the only thing that would make you take your turn quickly. Like, there was just so much stuff to consider.
Right. Yeah.
And it could...
like, you know, a real battle.
And it would take a while to actually secure a victory unless your opponent just GG'd out, you know? So, I wanted to, you know, in the board game space, people are really very particular about having games not take too long. They're very particular about a lot of things, but having them not take too long is one thing, especially that, like, it's on the front of every box, it's on the side, it's on the back.
Look at the little clock and see how long a game is going to take.
Yeah.
And, you know,
age players'
time. And if you go on, you know, board game design forums or, like, Facebook groups or whatever, it's something that people talk about a lot. You want your game to, you know, particularly if you're going for, like, mass market or, like, a party game or something like that, you want your game to not take more than 45 minutes.
Well, I feel that the timer is, like, an estimate, right? Because sometimes they'll say, like, 90 minutes on there, and it's 4 hours later, and you're just like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make your players play a game expeditiously, but...
But yeah. I feel like... if you have the 45 on there, I look at that and they say, with the people that I play games with, this is going to be a 90-minute game. That type of thing, right?
Yeah. And that's legit. But anyway, yeah, so, like, I had, you know, when I was playtesting True Messiah, I would have four-hour games with people. And I enjoy that sort of thing because I really like deep, complex strategy and I don't mind spending a long time sort of lost in that space. But when you're making a game, you gotta make certain considerations vis-a-vis marketability.
Right.
And I don't think a lot of people out there are interested in springing for even a very deep strategy game.
Hold on a second, sorry. Continue. Okay, so vis-a-vis marketability. So it was that also the motivation behind going from 2 to 4 or 2 to 3, 2 through 4? Players?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, like, strictly two-player games, you know, there are a few out there that
chess
do well.
Yeah. Chess.
Very popular.
Battleship.
Like, the most
they
recent...
They tend to be really old. Yeah.
Yeah, the most recent one I can think of that has done really well is Netrunner, right?
Right, yeah.
But, you know, by and large, when people get together to play board games, they're getting together with a group of friends, and the more you can accommodate different groups of players, the more likely your game is to get picked up off the shelf. And, you know, people are aware of that consideration when they're buying games, so it sort of behooves you to support as large a range of players as is feasible.
Yep. All right, so we're talking about audience considerations and time considerations. So, I guess, did you start out at a 4-hour mark and trim it down to 45, or was it more like average play time was like 90 minutes and you try to trim it down to 45?
So, I guess, it's hard for me to say because it's been a while. When I had the game done in college, right, it was a purely two-player experience, and you could easily have a match done within an hour between two, like, experienced players. When I expanded it to four players, however, I mean, that can take a while, even if everyone knows what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So my goal, essentially, was to reduce the amount of time it took to win the game without reducing the complexity of the decision-making involved in getting to that place.
Just add a card that says you win.
Yeah. Draw it out.
Easy peasy. I'm available for contract work as a game designer, by the way.
I see you're joking, but one of the things I did was I made the most powerful group of cards in the game more powerful. Right. So if you're able to obtain these like super powerful cards, there are much more direct routes to wrapping up the game with those cards.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That was one thing I did. Another thing I did was I just plain increased how much money players get over the course of the game, so that it's easier for people to obtain really powerful game-ending cards.
Right on.
Gotcha.
And I haven't seen that like negatively impact the complexity and the decision-making involved in the game at all. All it's done is just make it so that when you can win decisively and not have to like spend like seven rounds laboriously picking your opponent to pieces.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it is one of the kind of the big game fallacies, I think, of like beginning designers, is that you like to keep the game competitive, but you basically have a state where one person has won, but the game continues for a long time after that.
Yep.
So you kind of have to build in these like hard conditions to say like, okay, when this player is at this point, you basically just cull out all the rest of them.
Right.
Right. Like if you watch StarCraft II matches, right, they never win with the actual in-game win conditions. Like almost never. Almost never.
Mm-hmm.
It's always at one point a player's like, yeah, okay, you've got me beat, GG.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, that's actually, they've coded it in. If you type in GG in the console, you surrender.
Oh, that's neat. I didn't know that, actually.
So, yeah, same with Go. Almost no one finishes a game of Go.
Mm-hmm.
You just recognize that, you know, these territories are spoken for, essentially. There's no way I'd be able to defend them, so.
Nope.
Right, so I put that in the rules, actually, in Trumas. I was like, you know what? When all the other players agree that a certain player has won, that player wins immediately. Game over.
Right on.
It's interesting that the concede rules are important because, like, I played, like, big, like, multiplayer board games, and if you don't have rules for, like, one person concedes out early, it can really screw with the game, right? Because all of a sudden you have this headless empire that, you know, what do you do with it? So, yeah, I think concede rules are important to think about, especially for board games, right?
I don't want to let you go without talking about injection molding.
Oh, yeah. Super important.
Yes, the process, the sausage. Let's talk about that.
So, manufacturing board games is expensive. Shipping them is also really expensive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when you're designing the physical components of a board game, you not only have to take all these manufacturing considerations into account and, you know, the cost of components, but you also have to consider how heavy they are and how much it's going to end up costing you to ship them to everyone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that manufacturing board games becomes viable, I guess, cost-wise, is through volume pricing.
Mm-hmm.
So the more copies of a game you manufacture, the less each copy of the game costs to create.
Right.
Simply because there are certain fixed...
economies of scale.
Yeah, there are certain fixed upfront costs to the factory involved in setting up their dies to cut your pieces and blah, blah, blah. So the more copies of the game those fixed costs get spread across, the less you end up paying per copy.
Sure.
Plastic injection molding is a particularly large upfront fixed cost, and it's a... I believe I've read online it is widely considered to be not economical unless you're ordering 20,000 units or more.
Hmm.
That is a lot of units for an independent board game designer. Like, if you look on Kickstarter, a lot of board games that are successfully funded, they're funded, you know, let's say somewhere between, like, $50,000 and $110,000, right? These are, like, pretty successful Kickstarters. If you look at the number of backers they have, it's oftentimes not very many. Even, you know, if it raises $100,000, maybe it'll have, like, 1,100 backers.
Wow.
So a lot per backer, then.
Right. So backers are willing to pay quite a bit for a board game that they think looks cool. But the flip side of that is you're not going to actually sell, so to speak, that many through Kickstarter, even if you're successful.
Mm-hmm.
Which means a smaller run of the games, on the one hand, which means you pay more per game, which means you're making less profit. Or you go for a larger run, only get rid of...
Speculatively.
Yeah. Yeah, only get rid of some of them through Kickstarter, and then hope to God you can actually get the rest of them into retail and sell there.
Gotcha.
Which is kind of a difficult choice that I'm still grappling with at this moment in time.
So it'd be a good time now maybe to just ask, what's the plan from here?
So the plan from here is I've got like one set of components left that I want to get new art for. But other than that, like, it's art complete. I'm currently testing out one final set of changes with regard to two-player play, designed to speed up matches one versus one. And other than that, pretty much the plan from this point is to market the heck out of True Messiah at cons and such for a number of months, get a bunch of people interested in the game, aware of the game, get an email list so that I can actually let people know when the Kickstarter drops, and then run the Kickstarter. So
are you gonna shop for a publisher, or are you just
probably
die hard indie route?
I'm probably just gonna stick with the indie route.
Okay.
Most likely. Yeah, publishers are sort of a strange breed in the board game universe. They want to exercise a lot of creative control in a way that we are less used to now, being like video game indies.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Like, if you get picked up by a publisher, like, say, I don't know, Devolver Digital or something, or maybe even like,
they've just played your game, they liked it, and now they're going to publish it. Like, it's as simple as that. It's really...
Yeah. Whereas a board game publisher, if they see your game, they're going to want to fiddle with the rules.
Can it be kittens instead of messiahs?
They will want to change the theme oftentimes. And if you already have finished art, and they don't like your theme, they might tell you to just chuck it out.
And yeah, that's ceding a lot of control.
Right. And on top of that, you know, because the upfront costs are so high in board games, because you're paying for manufacturing and shipping just, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, you got to sell a fair bit before you really see any return as a developer if you're working with a publisher. Like, I remember...
So the contracts are often, like, minus cost, so the publisher makes their money back first. Is that how they're structured?
I believe so, yeah. I remember going to a PAX.
Now we're calling upon your lawyer skills to talk about the contracts.
To be totally honest with you, like, I like know a lot of what I know just from reading articles on the internet, and like, I attended a panel at some convention or other where they were talking about that. And there was like a panel of like actual just like board game publishers who were talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said on that panel that the royalty rate that's common when you go through a publisher for retail sales is like 5%.
Wow.
As a developer.
Wow.
That's kind of pretty tight. It makes the app store look really good.
So, you know, that's not something I'm particularly interested in doing, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm, you know, ceding creative control is my main point of contention, but beyond that, like a 5% royalty share is just terrible, in my opinion.
Maybe for a second run,
yeah.
If it does really well.
So,
you want to go global?
Yeah, and you know, for like a game like True Messiah too, it's like it's a game that's designed not just to be a good strategy game, but also as commentary, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to be a commentary on, you know, organized religion to some extent. And the board game market tends to be fairly conservative and, like, family-focused.
Mm.
And I don't really have much confidence that I could find a publisher that would leave the theme untouched.
Mm. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to me to, you know, not just make games, but also make games that, like, mean something.
Yeah.
So,
you know. So it sounds like you're pretty locked into the let's indie do this.
I'm pretty committed to the indie route at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if the game does well and a publisher approaches me with, like, really favorable terms and they're not going to, like, mess with anything, you know, then I would consider that. But for the time being, I'm mostly interested in sort of getting a manufacturing run out there and, you know, sort of wiping my hands of it and moving on to the next project.
Right on.
Go ahead.
Do you think that you'll go back to digital games or stick with tabletop for a while, or like, what's your feeling?
My guess is I'm probably going to go back to digital.
Okay.
Board games are a pretty cool space in some ways, like the cost and difficulty of actually making one is ridiculously small compared to video games.
Right.
Which is really nice. But marketing is a lot harder.
Speed, too, I imagine.
Speed, yes. Absolutely. It's much faster. But, you know, marketing is a lot harder. Just as a market, it's a lot smaller unless you're doing a very specific thing, like party games.
Mm.
Just, like, the manufacturing and shipping logistics issues are tough. what I've been considering, and I don't know if I'm going to ultimately stick with this, but what I've been considering is sort of churning out a digital version of True Messiah, just turning around the assets that I already have.
I was actually thought that I was going to, yeah.
And, you know, maybe like releasing it on mobile or some such.
Yeah.
I'm looking into that now as a possible next step once the physical board game is out.
Like with online multiplayer or with your, like,
so there's a number of ways you could do it, right? You could do it like a local only, or yeah.
Yeah, so I could do online multiplayer. I think it would be cool to do online multiplayer. I'm hesitant to announce that I'm doing online multiplayer because I...
Sorry, I forgot we were on a podcast.
Rob was literally just curious there.
I remember that was originally something I really wanted to do with Telepath Tactics. And then I realized that was actually impossible for me to do while also doing a single-player campaign. And, you know, some people got annoyed
about that. And
just
in general, like, you're really doing, you know, you're making a gamble that, like, the server uptime is going to be worth it for you. Like, there's going to be players there all the time.
Right.
Yeah,
no one likes to play in the ghost town, so...
Right.
Any plans for expansions off the original game if it does well? Have you thought about it?
Yeah, I actually do have ideas for an expansion, but I'm not really devoting a ton of time to it until I know that the original game is done well.
Because I always felt that was kind of like the sweet spot, right? When you have a popular, like Dominion, right? Dominion was a hit, and then they've released like 8 packs, right? And, you know, everyone goes and buys all.
I really liked your expansion to Telepath, the llama.
Oh, the guard llama.
The guard llama. That was awesome.
We should just keep it running. The llama should be a theme, so there should be a llama-themed messiah.
that would definitely fit that universe.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Like, a more of a puppet-type messiah where...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Where, you know, like a god that doesn't exert its own influence. There's somebody behind the scenes. I don't know. Interesting idea, Kiwan.
All right, so we can watch the gameplay video, and the Kickstarter will be somewhere in the nether part of this year.
Yeah, so I'm not committing to a specific time yet. Current idea is either sometime late-ish this year or very early next year. And the reason for that is simply because with board games, the math, basically, of sales is such that you want to get rid of as many copies as possible through a Kickstarter, mm-hmm. when you're running Kickstarter. There are just so many middlemen when you go retail that you ultimately see like a dramatically smaller share of any mm-hmm. given sale. So
Kickstarter will be your essentially primary store.
Kickstarter will basically be the game's launch. Right, that's basically how it works in the board game universe. Mm. And because I'm a first-time board game developer, and because there, for some reason, just isn't that much crossover between video game fans and board game fans, I'm sort of, you know, I've been sort of building up from scratch.
That's interesting. I was wondering if you were you needed to cultivate a new audience, or if there, you know, a lot of your telepath fans were going to follow you.
Yeah, there are definitely some who are enthusiastic about
it. It is a turn-based game, and there's, you know, there's some board gamey parts about Telepath.
Yeah, so one thing I learned when I was... So you may remember, right, I had an initial failed Kickstarter for mm-hmm. Telepath Tactics when the game was focused purely on multiplayer.
Mm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And especially on local multiplayer. And it people just were not nearly as interested in that as they were in single player. Mm. Like, a lot of the game's fan base are folks that, you know, for whatever reason, just don't get together with friends and play games in meat space.
People are scary.
So, you know, I don't think there's, like, going to be a huge amount of crossover between my existing fan base and people who will get True Messiah. I think, I know for a fact some people are super right. into it. But, you know, by and large, I've had to go out and cultivate interest as, like, a brand new face and not as someone who's been making games for 8 years or 10 years or however the hell long it's been.
I think the cost space would be interesting, though, because, you know, I feel when you're a video game person at a cost space, you're, like, another... person with just like a screen with something on it, whereas you will actually have physically cool things to show people.
It will be nice to show up with like 3D miniatures of the characters and like a board and cool looking cards. That'll that'll definitely be pretty gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Right on. You can just take pre-orders then and there too.
I could. The Oregon Trail guys were apparently just getting an envelope full of money, so this is a thing.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. I don't want to take pre-orders then and there. What I want to do is get their email addresses so that they contribute to the Kickstarter.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like, that 10% cut that Kickstarter takes, absolutely worth it if it means that I meet my goal and that I can get rid of as many copies as possible of whatever.
Because it's more visible when they... Like, they might tweet about it after they contribute to the Kickstarter or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. One sale might mean more than one sale.
Indeed.
Very interesting. Well, keep us posted. I mean, it's an interesting space for me to consider because I've always thought that it's, like, too much effort to, like, launch your first game because, like, even if you have a good game, there's still, like, all these hoops you have to jump through to, like, get in the market. So I've always thought about, there should be an easier way to do this. Well, and I've thought about board games, but from your trials, it sounds like it's just as much work to kind of push it through on that.
Yeah,
side.
It's
in different places.
Yeah, it's entirely in different places. Like, it's much, much faster and easier to actually make the game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, importantly, you can't have bugs in a board game.
I wonder.
You can, like...
Yeah, bust the strategy, though.
You can have holes in the rule set.
Yeah, you can have bad design. You can word your rules badly.
Where there is no rule for what you're about to do or whatever. I've had that happen a couple of times.
Yeah. I don't know. I categorize that under bad design.
Right.
Like, as far as, like...
It won't crash.
Yeah. Yeah, unless, like, you know, all of your players just simultaneously have a stroke or something.
Your game pieces are made of dynamite, and one of them happens to ignite.
Yeah, let's not play stroke game or dynamite game. I'm vetoing those for board game night.
Veto. I like them both, actually. It's more as, like, performance art than real board games. Sure. Just, like, imagine, like playing speed chess where if you don't finish in time, like, the queens will explode.
Well, no one's ever bored at your board game nights. Should we do a quick 5 minute what we're?
Yeah, sure.
You
have to start because I have no idea what I'm going to say.
So, let's see. We talked about House Cards last time. Oh, Daredevil. I've been watching a new season of Daredevil, which has been interesting. I'm about halfway through. It's good. You know, it's good. It's a really quality Netflix production, and I've been enjoying it. So, game-wise, I played Moon Hunters. So I finally showed up, and I've been really enjoying that, too. The way that they've treated the kind of, like, you build your own myth is very interesting. Mm. And I probably played it for 7-8 hours the first night. I'll say the one thing is that the one complaint I have is that I've beaten the game like 6 times, but I still haven't gotten the good ending.
Huh.
So I feel like there might be like more nudging needed for really bad players like myself. So, but yeah, I'd highly recommend it. Check it out.
Rubber banding.
Yeah, Moon Hunters from Kitbox Games.
Yeah. I've been watching a lot of Supernatural. Because it's sort of something that my wife has had on in the background while she works on her PhD.
We do a lot of these, like, background shows, right?
Yeah. But it is entertaining. It's better than I thought it would be, for certain. And I've discovered that the internet really loves Supernatural. And it's been on the air forever. But I'm only in, like, season 4 or something. There's like over 10 seasons.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that is a great background show then. You get just so much material.
It's very Buffy like. Mm-hmm. It's like it owes a lot to Buffy. It's just like dude Buffy. which is awesome. Instead of like describing things as the Lady X, which is, you know, like, you know, Ms. Pac-Man or whatever. In this case, it's the reverse. It's Dude Buffy. And I just played some Code Spells.
Okay.
Which is a project in development. It's obviously, like, pretty similar in theme and in intent to Codemancer, but it's meant to be sort of primarily a multiplayer experience. It's like, I think their sort of thesis in creating the game is, what if Minecraft was a fantasy game about programming? So it's very much like an open sandboxy thing, and there are some areas where there's goals attached, but it's very, very open-ended and meant to be sort of halfway between a game and a tool for creativity. So that was interesting, and I actually, like, taped my playthrough, so that'll be on YouTube soon.
Nice. We'll throw it up on the page as well.
Nice.
How about you, Craig?
Well, the girlfriend and I have been watching Buffy.
Right on.
Which I hear is the Lady Supernatural.
No, it is not. It is Buffy.
Indeed. And the last two games I played, you know, I played for IndieRPGs.com. I have this ridiculous backlog of indie RPGs that I need to check out for IndieRPGs.com checks out. And I don't know, for like a while there, I was trying to get back into it, but I just kept like trying games that people sent me and they just wouldn't record on Fraps.
Oh, huh.
Which was like, God, I have limited time in which to do this. Come on. So I found two that worked well recently, and I uploaded those. Those were Ballroom.
I've heard of it.
By Balcony Softworks, which is a pretty interesting survival crafting focused WRPG. And then there was also Celestian Tales Old North by Equator Games, I think it was. And that's a JRPG with some pretty good writing. You can, like, at the outset of the game, you choose one of six characters and you follow a kind of customized version of the storyline from their perspective throughout the game.
Cool. Very so nice. It's like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead kind of thing, where you see the same story from multiple angles.
A little bit, yeah.
Cool.
Let's do our quick pod sponsors.
Right on, yeah.
We are sponsored by InnoPrints. That's InnoPrints.com. And if you go to their site and use the promotion code CGS, you'll receive 15% off your next order. Get those cards for GDC or whatever con you're going to. Print all
GDC
your...
is done.
GDC is done, that's right. So whatever the summer cons are.
PAX.
PAX, yep. PAX is coming up.
PAX East.
And it is almost the end of tax season, so if you haven't already,
oh my goodness,
please go to General Ledger and get your damn taxes done.
Yeah, we know that you haven't done them yet.
Yeah,
it's okay.
I literally did mine today, so it's not too late. Go get it done. Talk to Marty, or just for next year, because you know that your experience this year was terrible. So don't repeat your same mistake next year. Go to Marty. If you let him know that you heard about him on our show, you'll get a free half-hour consult. I'm Kiwon Hong, at Kiwon Hong. My game is Contract Work, facebook.com/contractworkgame.
I'm Rob Lockhart, at Bobby Locks on Twitter, and my game is Codemancer, codemancergame.com. And you have quite a lot of things to promote, so why don't you give us the rundown on everything. Start with Telepath.
Oh, man, all right. I'm Craig Stern. My most recently, released game is Telepath Tactics, and
it's on Steam.
It is on Steam. Yep. So if you just look up Telepath Tactics on Steam, that will come up. I'm trying to remember if I actually have telepathtactics.com or not. I don't know if I do. But if you go to sinisterdesign.net, that's my developer website. It should be like in the top banner there.
Right on.
So you can click it real easy.
Okay.
So that's that, and then True Messiah is the board game I'm working on right now, and you can find out more about that by going to truemessiahgame.com. Messiah, again, is spelled M-E-S-S-I-A-H.
This is America,
yeah.
Where people can't spell, so thank you for that.
And if you like indie RPGs, I also run that site, so
exactly.
You can go to indierpgs.com and learn all about a bunch of indie RPGs.
And you also run the Chicago Indie Meetup?
I do the meetups for Indie City Games, and that is, theoretically, you can go to indiecitygames.com and learn about that, but I don't think that's been updated in about a year, so you should probably just look us up on Facebook.
Facebook is where it's at.
And the next meeting is...
April 2nd.
April 2nd.
That's it.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.